Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World around the world on Blog Talk Radio. I have to report to everyone that the tremendous heat wave that we've had in the Midwestern part of the United States is over. It was quite refreshing today. So we're loving the weather now in Indiana. So we'll wait till fall and, of course, hate winter and so forth. But it's great weather here in Indiana. Big hello to everyone. A big hello to one of our rabid listeners, I should say. From Lebanon, Indiana, big hello to Scott Carney, who listens in on the program every week and critiques it. He calls me and says how much he's enjoyed it. And also, a big hello to Daniel Falconer in New Zealand, who's listening tonight. And we've got a fantastic guest tonight. In fact, in a few moments, from the Buffalo Zoo in Buffalo, New York, Dr. Kurt Voley, the veterinarian, the head guy there at Buffalo. And we're going to talk to him about his adventures at the Buffalo Zoo and also a recent trip to Mongolia, which I know we're going to find quite fascinating. We want to warn everyone, I want to tell everyone coming up in the next few weeks. Next week on the program, Mark Chestnut with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and this is going to be kind of different, everybody, because Mark is probably the greatest sports fan in North America because it's going to be the start of the NFL season. We're going to chat with Mark. And I'm telling you, if you have an interest in sports, though, we've never done this before on this program, tune in because this guy he's been to over 3,000 sporting events live in person, and this is going to be a fascinating hour for the sports enthusiasts. And then week after, Michael Hodges from Rocky Mountain National Park, McGregor Mountain Lodge, the great mountaineer. We're going to find out about some of the peaks he scaled up there in the Rockies and some of the adventures he's been on. Then the week after that, Donna Shaver from Padre Island, and she's probably one of the foremost authorities on the Ridley Sea Turtle. We're going to talk to her about her rescue efforts there. And just back from the Celebes Islands, now called Sulawesi Island in Indonesia, Bill Yake's going to be here, the naturalist. We're going to talk to him about the work going on there in that part of the tropics in Indonesia. Then a week after, Bill Munns, Hollywood special effects man, who's worked on several films. The one film I always enjoyed, Quest for Fire. And also he worked on the classic Congo. We're going to talk about some of the work that he's done. As always, manning the Wild World News Desk, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson. You getting ready for the school season to start up?
We're getting ready for the school season. In fact, you must have been reading my mind. I've been on the phone all day chatting with school principals, old friends, and it's coming together pretty good. So we're interested in getting started. We're very excited about getting started. Of course, we're raising this new baby olive baboon. In fact, I'll talk to Dr. Voley about it a little bit later on. And things haven't changed. I pretty much get beat up every day. So we can't wait till it gets in front of hundreds of school children to have a chance to physically abuse me, but it's going to be a fun year, and we're looking forward to it. We'd like to go to the Wild World News with Dr. Day. I want to remind everyone, it's underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. If you're in the middle of thinking about producing a commercial or industrial film, whatever, it's all HD, go to jetkaiser.com. He's quite the artist, quite the cinematographer, and he'll do that for you, and he's underwritten our Wild World News tonight with Dr. Henry Day. Go ahead, Doctor.
All right. Well, tonight we're going to start out in Louisiana. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said it hopes to bring whooping cranes back into the South Louisiana area, establishing a flock that lives and breeds on state-owned land. The whoopers are the world's most endangered crane. There are fewer than 400 birds in the wild, and fewer than 150 captive. The Fish and Wildlife Service is seeking public comment on its plan to try to establish a flock at the White Lake Wetland Conservation Area, where the cranes once lived. Now, the only self-sustaining wild flock migrates between Wood Buffalo National Park in Northwest Territories of Canada and the Arenas National Wildlife Reserve in Texas.
Well, you know, we're going to have on in a few weeks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Mark Madison, and he just got back from Louisiana, and they were getting all the artifacts and papers and whatever is involved with the man who basically saved the whooping crane from extinction. And he was just got back from Louisiana, and I forget how many boxes of material they brought back to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's museum. They're in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. But he's all about that whooping crane. We're going to talk to him about that in a few weeks, so we've got that to look forward to.
Okay. Sweet. Yep. All right, let's go to Tabby Island, Georgia. Lifeguards have treated a record number of jellyfish stings this year. More than 10,000 stings have been treated this season, compared to with 7,500 last year and under 2,000 the year before. There have been a lot more tourists than usual, so that's part of the thing. But Dick Lee of the Skidaway Institute of Oceanography said that the jellyfish populations are increasing worldwide. And as you remember, a few weeks ago, we did a story from Italy where there were just thousands of stings where they're only used to having just a few a week. So the jellyfish are doing good this year.
Well, you know what I said last time. You know what they say? Even my mother-in-law, God bless her soul, said the remedy for a jellyfish sting is you just have your friend come in and you're
Oh, that's so, right, yeah.
There's a lot of people getting peed on this year, I bet.
Yeah, now when I lived in Florida, we used Adolph's meat tenderizer. That was our cure.
I remember you saying it, and it worked.
Yeah, it worked, wow. Yeah. All right, now listen to this story. All right, we're heading off to Britain. Falcon egg smuggler is seized in Britain. A former Special Forces soldier was jailed for 30 months after attempting to sneak out of Britain with a stash of 14 eggs of the rare peregrine falcon, a protected species there. Court testimony showed that Jeffrey Lindrum, 48, an Irish citizen, was trying to get to Dubai, where falconry is a national sport, and such eggs can fetch $11,000 each on the black market.
Wow.
He was caught when a cleaner spotted him behaving suspiciously in a business class lounge at the Birmingham International Airport. Now, for the eggs, the quick-thinking police made sure that they were kept warm. 11 of the 14 eggs have hatched, and most of the falcons have been returned to the wild.
So how was he transported?
$1,000 an egg.
Yeah, well, how was he transporting them? What made him look suspicious, did it say?
No. I'm sure he had them in a cooler, some type of something to keep them warm, styrofoam. But, you know, $11,000 an egg.
That's unbelievable. Of course, that's about the richest part of the world right there, that Dubois you're talking about. Okay.
All right. Well, if you're a panda lover, a giant panda has given birth to a healthy cub in Austria, the second in just 3 years. The Schönbrunn Zoo said Tuesday that the newborn measures 4 to 5 inches and weighs about 3.5 ounces. The cub has not yet been named, and its gender has not yet been determined. But they were discovered Monday that the panda was making noises, and they weren't quite sure what it was, but they found out that she had given birth, and she was excited about it, I guess. But there's only approximately 1,600 giant pandas that live in the wild now.
Right.
So anytime one is born, that's a wonderful thing.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal. Absolutely.
All right. You like alligators, don't you?
Not better. I have a few here.
Yeah, that's right.
Some of my best friends.
Brockton, Massachusetts. A 3-foot alligator with a collar around his neck was found crossing the street by a firefighter named Scott Hurst, who said he lifted the alligator by its collar and tail and tied it up in his pickup. Now, animal control supervisor Tom DeChellis said that he assumes the alligator is somebody's pet, but doesn't expect anyone to claim it.
It had a collar on it.
It had a collar on it.
Oh, Lord.
It was easy to capture. All right, you want another alligator story? Well, let's head to Chicago.
Oh, no.
A volunteer alligator hunter has captured one of the reptiles on Chicago's North Branch. The animal was snagged Tuesday by a member of the Chicago
Herpetological
Society, who said he had set up 5 traps out baited with raw chicken for the 3-foot alligator. And the alligator is the second one to be caught in the last month.
I'll be. That's wild because, you know, they have very, very strict regulations in the state of Illinois for the keeping of various exotic animals. And I'm sure alligator is on that list.
All right. Well, we're going to run off to Topeka, Kansas now. Since I'm a Kansas boy, I stack 2 Kansas stories right together.
There you go.
An 8-year-old Nile hippopotamus has given birth at the Topeka Zoo. The Topeka County Capital Journal reported that the visitors watched the delivery Friday night. The mother, Mira, had been on a contraceptive and was just found out to be pregnant this last Thursday.
Uh-oh.
She went through 3 hours of labor, and the sex of the approximately 60-pound baby has not yet been determined.
Well, it's because mama is very protective, and, you know, one of the most feared animals in Africa is the hippopotamus, one of the most dangerous animals to encounter in the wild.
Kills more people every year than alligators or tigers
or lions. Crocodiles. Not alligators, but crocodiles. Yeah.
They're crocodiles, right.
Yep.
All right, Manhattan, Kansas. Now listen to this.
Uh-oh.
Sunset Zoo said a 56-year-old chimpanzee who gave birth might be the oldest chimp in captivity to have a baby. Zoo officials announced the chimp, Susie, gave birth August 18th, and the mother and the baby are in good health. 56-year-old chimpanzee.
56 years old? That's not right. We're going to have to talk to Dr. Voli about that.
Right. I think we will. All right, now Yellowstone National Park, Billings, Montana. Listen to this. The grizzlies are going to be particularly hungry this fall, and that means more dangerous meetings with humans in a year that has already has the area's deadliest on record. Scientists report that a favorite food of many of the bears, nuts from the white pine, the white bark pine cones, is scarce. So as grizzlies look to put on pounds in preparation for the long winter ahead, scientists say they will be looking for another source of protein, which is meat, and running into trouble along the way. Now, the wildlife managers already report the bears coming down from the mountains into areas frequented by hunters, berry pickers, and hikers. So, well, the motto this year is pack your bear spray.
Well, let me tell you something right now. I was on the phone with Bob Jackson, former retired Yellowstone Park Ranger, who's been on the show twice and who patrolled the Thoroughfare District, which is the most remote area in the United States, which is in Yellowstone National Park. And I called him because we wanted to discuss the recent grizzly attacks in Yellowstone. And he says he knows that for sure those outfitters in that area were aware that that mother bear and cub, that they were a problem, because here's what's going on, folks. They're killing these elk right on the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park. They do this by using salt licks. And basically, these big-name, big-money guides that bring in these big-money clients, they're killing these elk, and they're taking heads and antlers and leaving the rest, and the bears are looking at this as a feeding station. So this is what's creating a lot of this problem on the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park. And that's probably what created the problem in that that person was killed recently in Yellowstone. Those two other mauled. So it's a very serious situation. It's just too bad we don't have another Bob Jackson out there to patrol that area. But that's what's going on there. Okay, I'm off my soapbox.
All right, now here's a little bit of a sad story, but I have to tell you this because it's important. Bonita Springs, Florida. Baby loggerhead turtles have died after crawling towards land-based lights instead of the horizon of the Gulf. Eve Haverfield, founder of Turtle Time, a nonprofit organization, said that one of the nests near a home where two bright lights were aimed towards the beach held 112 eggs. A Bonita Springs official said that it will send a notice of violation to the property owner.
Well,
a simple thing like lights on the beach.
Absolutely. And, you know, how long do they have to sacrifice those lights? I mean, what, a couple weeks, you know, till the turtles are established?
Yeah, exactly.
So the people, they need to, you know, they want to live on the beach. They want to live with nature, so they need to abide by nature's rules sometimes. And that would be, I would think, be very appropriate for them to do is to kill those lights in that particular time of the year.
All right. Well, we're running a little long tonight, so let's finish up the story here locally. In Linton, Indiana, wildlife officials said the first biodiversity survey at Indiana's largest wetland restoration area is likely to find more than 100 species of plants and animals. The Indiana Department of Natural Resources said researchers of Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area have found nearly 400 species of plants, 124 species of birds, and 88 species of butterflies and moths.
Wow. That's not too far from the massive compound and studios here in Clinton Falls.
Well, that's right.
That's, if you're in a hurry, you'd be there in an hour. So that's fantastic. So that's the Wild World News tonight, Dr. Day.
That's it for the evening.
The Wild World News has been underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. If you're in the middle of planning and preparing a corporate film or any type of thing that you need film work done, JetKaiser.com. He's the man you want to talk to. He's an artist. He'll go anywhere in the world, so keep that in mind. We also would like to thank all of our underwriters that keep Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio, such as We Want You Cottages way up in western New York, Chautauqua Lake. Peter and Kathy Weimer, they're the proprietors, and they have a very exciting new website called iKids Fishing, where youngsters that have caught that big whopper can download the photo and compare it to youngsters all across the country. You know, anything to get the kids interested in going into the great outdoors. If fishing takes it, let them do it. Very exciting. That website, is www.wewantchu.com. Over in western New York, or give them a call, 716-789-3383. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful and scenic Estes Park, Colorado, right on the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. Folks, it's absolutely spectacular. Any time of the year, keep this in mind. The time to go is in the fall and winter months. There's not so many folks there. You have the place to yourself. And what a splendid place to stay. They have lodge, cottages, right on the edge of the park. You may have bighorn sheep and elk in your backyard. It's that fantastic. So that's McGregor Mountain Lodge. And Michael Hodges is going to be on in a couple of weeks. We're going to talk to him about some of his recent mountaineering adventures in the Rockies. Also, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. This place is known for world-class fishing. Been there. It's fantastic. It's so big, it looks like an ocean. And they take you out on those boats, and you hook, man, the catfish, it's incredible. Anywhere from 10 to 100 pounds. That's what's swimming around in those lakes. 7-state record, 1-world record. Their website, SanteeCooperCountry.org, O-R-G. Or give the girls a call. They can plan your whole trip, your guides, your reservations, your boat rentals, whatever you need. That number, 800-227-8510, Santee Cooper Country. Tonight on our program, we have with us an old friend I've known for a long time. Man, he's really, his career has just exploded. He's now at the Buffalo Zoo in Buffalo, New York. He's a Hoosier who had a chance to meet many, 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 many years ago. He's also our vet for our little menagerie here for a long time. We'd like to welcome from the Arctic country of Buffalo, New York, Dr. Kurt Boley. Hi, Doc.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
Oh, well, that's great. One of the questions I want to ask, how are you adjusting to the Arctic cold country of Buffalo, New York? How many years have you been there now?
Going on the fourth year now. And really, it's not nearly what we were expecting at all. We had a lot of people tell us how thick the snow was going to be, and it really hasn't been bad within Buffalo.
Really?
Apparently, it usually snows in what they call the South Town areas, southern counties, and it seems like when you watch the weather maps, it kind of diverts north of us, too. So Buffalo almost is the eye of the storm, the way it looks on the weather maps. So it really hasn't been that bad, and Buffalo does a great job of getting the roads cleaned. So it doesn't matter of fact, it almost seemed like there was more trouble getting from place to place when we were in Indiana than up here.
Well, you know that's true because as we were talking before the program, I used to come up into New York a lot. We do programs in Syracuse and Rochester. Oh gosh, Victor, New York, Fayetteville, New York. And we'd be there in February and March and January, and like you said, they'd get a big snow, and by the next morning, the roads are fairly clear. They've got the equipment to move it, which is a good thing. So how does it affect the zoo when you get a big snow like that?
It can definitely slow things down a little bit, but we're pretty fortunate. We've got a crew that cleans the pass pretty well and cleans the removes the snow from the outside, beyond the perimeter fence area as well. So we were able to get around. Initially it's a little bit tough, and we travel from place to place. Our vet staff travels from building to building with a little vehicle called a gem car, and it's got some limited capability in deeper snow. So sometimes we end up just having to walk from place to place. But it's good exercise.
So when it gets cold weather, what animal seems to, in your collection, because the obvious answer would be polar bears, but who seems to enjoy that cold winter weather the most?
I definitely think the polar bears thoroughly enjoy it. They usually have there's a hose that they keep running purposefully to kind of make sure that there's constant flow of water, but it usually forms this stalagmite of ice near one of the pools, and by the end of the wintertime, it's huge and very, very picturesque, really, and the polar bears love it. They love to play on it, and I think they get a lot of behavioral enrichment from it. But aside from the polar bears, I think our Eurasian lynx enjoy it a lot, and bighorn sheep seem to do very well with it. Snow leopards love it, so I think we've got a fair number of species that get a lot out of that snowy weather.
You had to. What was your first thoughts? Now, growing up, if I'm not mistaken, in Spencer, Indiana.
Actually, Freelandville, Indiana.
Freeland?
Freelandville, yeah. It wasn't too far from Spencer, but
so, okay, from Freelandville, Indiana.
Yes.
And you walk into this massive complex known as the Buffalo Zoo. You must have thought, you must have been a kid in a candy store.
Yeah. It's been pretty enjoyable.
I mean, you have to love every day that you go to work.
Yeah, I do. I do. It's always a different, nothing is ever the same. It's always different every single day. And minute by minute, things change.
It's like a, I've always compared, of course, ours is very small scale to what you're working with there, but it's almost like the animal community is a community in itself, where if things are just a little different, it just bugs the heck out of them. It's almost I almost compared it to like a nursing home. If dinner is not served by 4 o'clock, they're not going anywhere, but they're wondering where in the heck is that.
Yeah.
So I would assume that you have a fantastic group of keepers, because basically the keepers are your eyes and ears, right?
They sure are. They sure are. They're monitoring, really every little thing that goes on with their animals. They know them inside and out. And, if an animal does something slightly different from its normal day-to-day activities, and they alert me to it.
I think they're
pretty good, very observant.
Well, and a lot of people, and I think you would agree with me on this, wild animals are not unpredictable.
They are relatively predictable. That is true. They're very good at masking a lot of things, though, too. They're very good at trying to prevent the average person, the average animal, from noticing that they may not be feeling quite as well. So it's really important that keepers and, you know, our veterinary staff, that we're very in tune with subtle changes, so that we can kind of jump on things before, you know, before the animal can no longer put up that disguise.
That's just wild instincts, isn't it?
Yep, it definitely is. You know, if they look like they're sick or they're not doing well, then another animal in the group may decide that they want to be the dominant animal of the group and push them out or fight with them. Or, you know, if an animal looks really, really under the weather, then predators zero in on that. And that's one of the first animals to be taken by a predator if they think they've got a weak animal that they can go after.
Is there a particular animal that you've worked with so far in the 4 years? I'll say the short 4 years you've been there, because I know time just flies. If it's something you love as
it
much
does.
as you do. Is there one particular animal that you've really been quite keen on? People always look at me weird when I say I learned from the animals. But is there one animal in that you've worked with, or maybe more than one, that you've actually said, wow, I never had any idea that they were capable of all that, or something like that that was just basically blew you away?
You know, I could say that with so many different species. There's so, you know, every single day you find exceptions to the rule, things that an animal does that you wouldn't have expected them to be able to accomplish, and so, you know, there's so many of them that are fascinating to me. It's always hard for me to say there's any one particular one, but, you know, I'm always amazed at what, you know, our various monkey species will do over time. You know, the things that they enjoy doing, or the things that they come up with to, you know, to enhance their day-to-day activities. But you know, I think primates are a really fascinating group in general. I think birds are a very fascinating group. There's so many things that you see on a daily basis that you think, what an amazing adaptive animal this is. You know, some of the fascinating species that we have: boat-billed herons, roseate spoonbills, and, you know, just being able to see how they move about their exhibit, how they try to find food, with some of the ways in which the keepers present food is by scattering that food so that they look for and hunt for that food to try to provide some behavioral enrichment, and, you know, just seeing what they do with that is pretty amazing. Our spoonbills have a very, very sensitive beak, lots of little nerve endings in the end of it, and just watching them kind of sift through the water. We have a wetlands area in our rainforest exhibit, and they will dip their beak in that water to try to search for really small food items that they can glean out and consume. And, you know, just seeing how the boatbills, they've got a pretty fascinating beak shape themselves that they use in their natural habitat to catch frogs, as a matter of fact. So it's very soft on the underside, almost pelican-like without the huge sac. And, you know, just to see how they utilize that in grabbing food, how they use it to keep cool. You know, they actually will flutter that area, you know, as a means of trying to let off heat. And, you know, it's incredible how animals use various things for different purposes each day, from an anatomical standpoint.
I've always heard, years ago, a gentleman told me that as far as the zoo's concerned, that the greatest demand for an expert or a person that has an expertise is birds, because we're dealing with so many species, and they said that's really tough to find.
Yeah, I think as time goes on, there are more and more people that have become interested in birds. I think mainly because the current trends in the pets in the United States is that more and more people are keeping birds, and so there are more veterinarians out there that are realizing how fascinating birds can be. Definitely some of the fascinating species that we're able to keep in a zoo collection, you know, really expand that exposure, you know, compared to some of the ones that people may keep in their household as household pets. You know, we see things that they wouldn't have access to so easily.
Right.
And you know, birds with absolutely amazing variety of shapes and forms and abilities.
You wouldn't run into some little old lady having a hornbill in her trailer.
Not normally.
But anyway, we're going to take a short break. Dr. Volley, if you'd like, get you a cold beverage. We're going to be taking a few moments off here with some public service announcements. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World live on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Duty, freedom, country, family. They're the values that make America strong and what our armed forces are fighting to defend. While many talk about these ideals without action, they are just empty words. If you think America's military families deserve more, log on to thanksusa.org. It's a great way to thank our troops and give military families the gift of education. thanksusa.org. Scholarships for America's military families. You can make a difference.
Hi, this is Pat Green. The blood supply is at critically low levels, and you can help. Call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE. That's 1-800-GIVE-LIFE to schedule your appointment to donate blood. Your donation is critical because every 2 seconds someone in America needs blood. That's accident victims, surgical candidates, and cancer patients, just to name a few. Please donate blood and encourage your friends, family, and neighbors to give too. Please call the American Red Cross at 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org to make your appointment. Thank you.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at TakeMeFishing.org.
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling. What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters.
Ish, bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, not.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson from Clinton Falls, Indiana, the massive Blog Talk Radio studios. Tonight's guest, Dr. Kurt Voley from the Buffalo Zoo in Buffalo, New York. We'll be back with Dr. Voley in just a couple moments. We want to remind everyone that we're underwritten by several folks to keep our program on the air here on Blog Talk Radio, such as Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Known for world-class fishing, they hold 7 state records and 1 world record. Go to their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org, or call the girls. They're in charge of the tourist department, and they'll be more than happy to set up your guide for fishing, maybe even book a golf expedition. That number is 1-800-227-8510. Also, a big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, right on the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. And it's absolutely fantastic. If you've ever been to the western part of this country, you owe it to yourself to go. What a great place to stay. And even think about the winter months, because I'm going to tell you right now, it's kind of like when we were talking about Buffalo, New York. They know how to clear the roads in Estes Park, Colorado, I guarantee it, and it will not interfere with your good time there at the McGregor Mountain Lodge. Their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, or call their 800 number, 1-800-835-8439. Also, big thank you to We Want You Cottages, way up in western New York, not too far from Dr. Voley and the Buffalo Zoo on Chautauqua Lake, and it's a fantastic resort. And also, they have a very exciting new kids fishing website. It's called iKids Fishing, where youngsters can download that picture of that big whopper they caught this year and compare it with youngsters all across the country. And that website is www.wewanchu.com. As we had mentioned moments ago, our guest tonight, very happy to have him on board, Dr. Kurt Voley from the Buffalo Zoo in Buffalo, New York. Doc, I was going to talk to you about this recent trip that you took, which I find absolutely fascinating, to probably, I don't know, I would think it would be probably one of the most unknown areas, Mongolia. How did that all come about?
Well, I was actually at a Midwest Zoo Veterinarians meeting. There's a group of veterinarians from the Midwestern states that meet, and it's a continuing education forum for all of us. And one of the speakers that we had was Dr. William Swanson from the Cincinnati Zoo, and he is the director of animal research there at the, it's called CREW, the Center for Research of Endangered Wildlife. And he was talking about his trips to Mongolia to work with palace cats. And he mentioned, you know, is there anyone in the crowd that would actually be interested in going to Mongolia? And at first I thought he was joking, and he was serious. So I went up and, you know, asked what the details were and said, yeah, I'm very interested in going. And luckily our zoo has a program called Cars for Conservation, so that a portion of the proceeds from our parking lot fees go towards conservation projects. And through that, I was able to fund
some of my expenses to go and assist with this palace cat project. And what they, one major goal of the project, and there are several, but one of the goals is to assess what the seroprevalence, or what the exposure is to toxoplasma, which is a protozoan parasite, a single-celled organism that parasitizes any warm-blooded animal, actually. But it causes tremendous mortality in palace cats in captivity, especially the young kittens. So one of the goals is to get blood samples from palace cats and also some other things. They're like the domestic livestock, the sheep, nomadic herds of sheep and goats, and also some of the bird populations and rodent populations that are in Mongolia, so that the actual exposure level to those palace cats can be assessed. Because as it appears, Mongolia is almost like an island, in a sense, free of toxoplasma, or at least in a reduced exposure to toxoplasma. And, in people, it's considered a zoonotic disease, meaning that we can actually, people can actually get it from domestic cats. Domestic cats and other cats are considered the definitive host, meaning that they can, the organism, the toxoplasma organism, can complete its life cycle in cats specifically, but not in other species. In other species, it just goes along, can infect, but cannot complete its life cycle. So it's believed that because Mongolia is such an arid, cold climate during a portion of the year, or a good chunk of the year, that, and because there are very, very few cats in general in Mongolia, and domestic cats don't seem to be a very popular pet amongst Mongolians,
really?
That has diminished the exposure of these palace cats to toxoplasma. So when they do get exposed to it, it's a really, really big deal. And that's why the mortality rate is so high. It's kind of like the same situation in lemurs and in kangaroos. For many, many, many years, they have had no exposure to cats on the island of Madagascar and, on the continent of Australia. And
right.
So kangaroos, wallabies, lemurs are all very, very susceptible to toxoplasmosis, and it kills them in a very fulminant way. So anyway, the trip was to try to get blood samples from as many cats as we could catch, and also we were able to sample 45 rodents of three species. There are many, many rodents throughout the area that we were staying. And also, they were able to work with some other researchers in Mongolia to get samples from birds and also from some of the human clinics in Ulaanbaatar. I believe they were able to get some blood samples that were voluntarily given from people so that they could assess what the human exposure may have been. And then we went to Nomad's Gear, which is their shelter. They don't really have set farms. They migrate from place to place, and we were able to sample about 150 sheep and goats from a family's stock.
So, how much of a challenge was it to catch these palace cats? Because I know cats are so wary. I can't even imagine.
It was incredibly challenging, and we would get up in the morning at 3 o'clock, drive in our Russian van to, various sites out around this area called Altan Bulag, and we'd climb these very tall mini mountains, they're huge, huge hills, and once you're at the top of the hill, you get out your binoculars to try to watch for the cats emerging from their little rock crevices or from abandoned marmot burrows. That's where they like to hide during the daytime. But in the morning, they're more active and they come out of those. But while you're up at the top of these hills, the wind is so incredibly strong that it feels like it's going to blow you literally off the top. And your only shelter at the top of the hills are these, they're called cairns or owas, these piles of rock that seem to exist on every single little peak of a hill or mini mountain in that area. And you have your back against these to try to brace yourself away from the wind while you're watching. But extremely vast area, and these cats are very, very small. They're only, you know, they're about 10 pounds or less, so they're very, very small. So you really spend a lot of time looking for them and trying to find a burrow that might be a possibility. In the wintertime, it's easier, but since we were there during the summertime, at the very end of breeding season, things were different. So
what would that have been like to go there in the winter, though?
Well, I'd like to, Dr. Vogley, I'd want to let you know that the Fargo Zoo in North Dakota has had five of the palace cats born there in June. Now, you know, it says that they have really proven to be hard to breed in captivity. Last year they had kittens born, but like you said, they didn't survive.
Did you know that, Dr. Vogley?
I hadn't heard that event yet, but yeah, palace cats they have some challenges in a captive setting.
Well, you were talking about watching for these cats with binoculars. They have to have a camouflage where they're just so difficult to see. What was the trick?
In the wintertime, you can actually, because they tend to be slower, they tend to be heavier over the wintertime, they tend to be a little bit, it's more difficult for them to navigate through the snow, and they can follow them to the burrows, and they can find them more readily by tracking their tracks. But during the summertime, it was extremely difficult to find them, and luckily we had some very, very skilled Mongolians with us, and they can see better than eagles. I think they're amazing at their ability to spot these cats. I have the highest respect for them, all the Mongolian folks that worked with us. But they were able to see them from long distances and track them down to catch them.
Probably without even binoculars.
Yeah, actually, some of them did, you know, they would stop using their binoculars at times because they could see things a little bit better without. But they too did use binoculars at times.
So what was your first impressions of Mongolia when you got there? Where did you fly into? What was the transportation involved getting to where the research was going on?
Well, first flew into South Korea to Incheon Airport, and then from there flew to the capital city of Ulaanbaatar, and it's called Chinggis Khan Airport. And impressions were, things were very contrasting because the capital city, densely populated, and what was really fascinating was the housing. There were areas that, and there was one in particular called the Shangri-La. A hotel was being built, very, very modern-looking architecture, unique-looking architecture. And, you know, various skyscrapers, you know, in that area. But even on top of some of the tallest buildings, there were nomad gears that had been set up. So you could look out your hotel window and see a gear on top of one of the buildings with a little smokestack. And,
really?
You know, in those stoves that they have inside the gear, which are, they kind of remind me of a shortened teepee, but yet they're more cylindrical. Not as cone-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
But the stoves that are inside those burn horse dung.
Really?
And that's their main fuel. You know, it's dry horse dung, and they use that to heat the inside, and it does a pretty good job.
I'll bet.
And we ended up having to use that in ours at our camp area. So But anyway, it was very contrasting because as you leave the capital city, it very rapidly turns into this big open, vast, hilly area, and you know, the population density is decreased dramatically at that point. The roads change. You go from asphalt to this rocky, then just dirt road with lots of ruts. So it's a pretty rough vehicle ride out to your study site. But
go ahead.
It was a very relaxing area, though, I must say. You know, it's such a contrasting trip from a real bustling city of Ulaanbaatar out to the countryside where you see a gear, you know, once in a while. But as far as your eyes can see, all of a sudden you might see a gear off in the distance, but there's very, very, very few people in a given area.
So did they have a McDonald's in the capital there where you flew into?
You know,
was it that up to date?
I don't remember seeing a McDonald's. They did have
that's
a Coca-Cola bottling factory.
They did.
But
wow.
Yeah, but I don't remember seeing a McDonald's there. There was a variety of restaurants. There was an Indian restaurant, there was a French restaurant, as a matter of fact. But I don't remember seeing a McDonald's.
How were the native people towards you, and how was that relationship?
Really, overall, great. I think they're a little bit more reluctant in the city to be, you know, kind of like some of the big cities that we have here. You know, that people don't, you know everyone. You know, unlike the country, the rural area that I grew up, where everybody waves as you drive down the road.
Absolutely.
But in Ulaanbaatar, you know, they're kind of reluctant to go up to strangers and talk. You know, if you want to ask directions, well, they're kind of leery about stopping to help with that. But you know, some people would. And we were looking for a monastery when we first got there. You know, just as opportunity to see that before we went out to the study site, and you know, some people were much more eager to help us than others. So it's contrasting, but out the study site and the nomads in the gears that surrounded our study site, they were very, very friendly, congenial people. So it had to be
for the Buffalo Zoo and yourself an unbelievable experience, because the knowledge that you could gather on one of these trips, you can never learn in a classroom. You can never
read it. That's exactly right.
And it's very important. You know, a lot of times people say, well, we're given a grant to make a frog crossing. Well, why not? Because people don't realize that the quality of life on this planet depends on our natural world. And even a palace cat way off in Mongolia says, who cares about that? But we should care, because of all these species that, we're discovering species every day, but we're also losing them at the same time. And I just think it's fantastic that the Buffalo Zoo and the people behind the Buffalo Zoo would find the wherewithal to send you on this trip, because I will say something to Dr. Bull I've never said. The Buffalo Zoo should consider themselves very lucky, because of all the people, and I've been working with wild animals for close to 35 years, I will have to say, in the veterinary field, that there is no one person who's more conscientious, more thoughtful, more thorough than Dr. Bowley, and I think the Buffalo Zoo should count their blessings every time you walk in there and give your expertise and your knowledge to that very, very lucky collection of animals in New York. Because Well, it's true. I've been to the zoo, we mentioned earlier, I'd gone there several times, because we'd be up in there in that area doing wildlife programs, and I always loved coming to the Buffalo Zoo. It was always an adventure. Every part of it, I have to tell you a little story, though. I've never really said this before, but of course, we were leaving Rochester, New York, and we were going to plan on stopping at the zoo. And I was still in my animal guy clothes, you know, the khaki pants, the khaki shirt, a little goofy Jungle Gym hat on, you know, which I'd wear every day anyway, so I didn't think anything about going in public in it. It just seemed natural to me. And I'd find as I'd walk through the zoo, the animals would, you know, oh, there's a keeper. Never met him before. But, you know, it was funny to watch him get their attention. But the moment that I remember, and the zoo is probably not going to lie, this happened so many years ago, so I'm walking up, and there's an ostrich display, and in the middle of the ostrich display, or in the front of it, says, please do not feed the animals. Well, I'm looking over there, and there's some guy tossing popcorn in this ostrich for this ostrich. I come unglued. He thought I worked at the zoo. I berated him for 5 minutes. I think I even followed him through the zoo. I think my first response was I pointed to the sign and said, can you not read that sign? And I'm sure there's many, probably every keeper that's worked at the zoo has bitten their lips so many times and have loved to have had that moment. But they'd have probably threw me out of the zoo and even if they'd found out I did that. But it made me feel good at the time. But it was, that was funny. So I know that the Dr. Voley is quite the, he has quite the fondness for the reptiles. I haven't been up to the zoo in a long time. You have some new additions to your reptile collection, I heard.
Yes, we do. But are you talking about the amphibian side of things?
Oh, I don't care, Doc.
Because we actually do. We've got quite a few hellbenders as part of a project called the Hellbender Head Start Program.
Yeah.
And we initially collected 744 eggs from the Allegheny watershed area because there's been a concern that wildlife biologists have been able to find eggs, they've been able to find adults, and these are salamanders that live to be, you know, 30 years old, and they're finding like 25-year-old salamanders, but they're not finding the young juveniles. So, you know, the big concern was, why are there no juveniles? What's really happening with them? You know, what is preventing them from getting to that stage? And so what we did was collect those eggs in coordination with the DEC, and we brought them into our zoo and separated them, hatched them, and we got 744 eggs to hatch. And we now have, I should say 634 eggs to hatch, and we now have 540 hellbenders. Some of those 634 actually went to two other zoos. So there are other zoos that are participating in the program, but it's hoped that we will be able to raise them to about the 3.5 year mark, and then they'll be released.
And that is such an impressive amphibian. They are just, I mean, next to the giant salamander of China, the hellbenders, just they'd have to make a fantastic display.
Yeah.
That's the one. You know, and I always said that the reptile department, most zoos on any given day, that's usually the area that's the most crowded. People are so frightened and afraid of whatever. They're fascinated by these things, but it's always been, I've said over the years, probably the most popular part of the zoo next to the primates, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Foley, gosh, it's been a pleasure. We really loved having you on the program. I'd like to bend your ear again down the road. New stuff going on. I'm sure they're going to send you somewhere else to do research to help the Buffalo Zoo. And as I mentioned earlier, the Buffalo Zoo is very lucky to have Dr. Kirk Voley on their staff. And
thank you.
And their animals are in good hands. And I'll tell you what, Doc, next time I'm through that area, I will definitely stop in. Because
that'd be great.
We love the Buffalo Zoo. Go to their website. I'm not sure the website address, but I was checking it out the other day. It was fantastic. But just Google Buffalo Zoo, Buffalo, New York, and you'll see it. And also, they have several areas where you can contribute to the zoo, and we recommend everyone to do that. We'd like to thank, of course, Dr. Henry Day for the Wild World News, Eric Altman for his technical expertise in Pennsylvania. Next week on the show, as I told everybody, we're going to have, it's going to be a big sports night. Get ready for the NFL football season. Mark Chesna of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. On his weekends, he travels all over the country. He's been over to 3,000 events, NBA, NFL. It's going to be wild, so you need to tune in. We'd like to thank Dr. Kurt Foley of Buffalo Zoo, and check him out. You know, go to the zoo, man. Support him. This is Larry Batson, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.